I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation today with a college professor who says college presidents earn way too much, and a college president who says more people need to know what we presidents do. But first, the last showdown at the OK Corral. OK, it's really the lame duck session of Congress, but it's the last confrontation between this Congress and the Bush White House, both at odds for years. Many of the lawmakers returning to work today have lost their reelection bids, won't be back in January. But with an economic crisis and a new administration coming in, Congress has a full agenda today. Item number one, a possible rescue plan for Detroit, but also on the agenda, what to do about Joe Lieberman. Well, joining us from Capitol Hill, David Lightman, national correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And David, to the possible bailout first of the auto industry, White House Press Secretary Dan Perino issued a statement early today saying the Bush administration does not want U.S. automakers to fail. A signal to Congress?
Yeah, I'll say, because as long as the administration takes that stance, they're going to need, you know, 2/3 votes to cut off a possible veto, and if Republicans decide to filibuster, that's 60 votes in the Senate. So, yeah, that's tough talk.
Well, and what's the discrepancy? I mean, we know Congress wants to use money from the bailout bill for Detroit. The White House doesn't?
That's right. They feel that bill, first of all, was meant to rescue financial institutions. Dana Perino, the White House spokeswoman, made it clear this morning, if you start down this road of helping ailing industries, what's next? Actually, one of the Republicans last week had a good line. He said, well, we bail out Circuit City next. I mean, how does this work? Every restaurant in somebody's district? It's an interesting philosophical argument. But
right. And the White House wants to use money from a Department of Energy bill that was approved earlier this year. Now there's further splits. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has embraced an auto bailout, but President-elect Obama said last night on 60 Minutes that, yes, the auto industry needs help, but not a blank check.
That's right. Pelosi put some restrictions on what she wants. She announced Saturday afternoon, including some restrictions on executive pay. There'd be tough, what they call oversight of this stuff. So Pelosi says it's not a blank check. We're going to watch very, very closely.
And we know as well that there's going to be a lot of leadership sort of dancing going on today because, you know, first of all, you have Joe Lieberman. He was, of course, infuriating Democrats for his backing of Republican John McCain, and he was chair of an important committee. What's going to happen?
Well, that's a good question. You know, if you had talked to me late last week, I would have said he may be stripped of his chairmanship, but he'll stay at the Democratic caucus, keep his coveted seat on the Armed Services Committee. Senator Dodd, his colleague from Connecticut, was pushing not to punish Lieberman too harshly. But there are other voices in that Democratic caucus that say, no, this is ridiculous. He went out there and not just supported John McCain, but he actively worked against Barack Obama, spoke at the convention, and so on. So it's going to be one of these very secret ballot things probably tomorrow, and I wouldn't predict right now.
And on the Republican side, Republicans have to decide what to do about Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. He's been convicted of ethics violations. What's your thought there?
Yeah, my favorite quote, again, Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho, when we asked him last Thursday or Friday, what's going to happen, he said, well, the other guy's ahead by a couple votes.
So they're going to pray.
Yeah, they don't want to fool with this one. No, they're just hoping this thing takes care of itself.
Right.
They hate this.
But if not, they may have to consider stripping Stevens of committee posts, you know, if he does ultimately win the election. Well, and there's also a battle brewing over the chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. This is on the Democratic side. Tell us about that.
This is interesting because Henry Waxman, the congressman from California, longtime gadfly, highly respected, close to Nancy Pelosi, is challenging John Dingell, the veteran chairman, close to Detroit, big constituency in Congress. Odds are right now Dingell's got it, but boy, Waxman has a lot of support. It's almost, I want to say, a generational battle, but it's a real clash in philosophies here. Waxman's always been very consumer-oriented, very tough on industry. This is going to be ugly.
And important, the decision is important because this is going to be a crucial battleground for Barack Obama's initiatives on health care,
exactly.
Global warming.
Well, that's the point I was going to make. Health care, energy, regulatory policy all goes through that committee. Now, frankly, I don't think Dingell and Waxman are that far apart on most of this stuff. Dingell has always been a real Democratic loyalist, but it's going to be a question of tone, degree, emphasis, and so forth.
David Lightman, national correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We should say that one piece of legislation expected to pass through this lame duck session, an extension of unemployment benefits, very much needed. David, thank you so much for your observations.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.
Well, the financial crisis is affecting higher education, with some colleges closing, which is why a study of the high salaries of university presidents is raising eyebrows. As one of our next guests says, this annual report always causes a tizzy and then everyone forgets about it. But others are asking, is it time to do something about college presidents' salaries? The Chronicle of Higher Education survey says 59 public university presidents were paid more than $500,000 last year. That's 16 more presidents than the year before. And more private school presidents received a $500,000 a year salary as well, with David Sargent of Suffolk University here in Boston topping the list at $2.8 million a year. The study includes commentaries from our next guests. Sanford Unger is president of Goucher College, a private school outside Baltimore. And public radio listeners might recall Sandy hosted NPR's All Things Considered from 1979 to 1982 before joining the halls of higher earning. And Sandy, I'm sorry, I can't resist, but you say that's one of the lines that the media comes up with every time this study is released.
Right, right. There's, you know, we're convenient targets. I mean, higher education in general is a target at the moment in the United States. Was true even before the economic and financial crisis, and so why not go after the heads of these institutions and ask tough and embarrassing questions of them? I think it's fine to ask those questions. I think the answers may be a little different from what people think, though.
Well, I'm not sure that they'll be embarrassing, but we have a couple questions for you. But first, we want to introduce Mark Bousquet. He's Associate Professor of Cultural Studies at Santa Clara University, a private Jesuit Catholic school. His latest book is How the University Works, Higher Education in the Low-Wage Nation. And Mark, you say these may be the halls of higher earning, except if you're an adjunct professor?
That's correct. I think the real story here is that most administrators don't earn anything near the range of presidents at research universities, and most faculty don't earn anything near what the administrators earn, and most faculty don't earn what professors earn, because the majority of faculty, over 70% of all faculty, are on contingent appointments, many of them earning just a few tens of thousands of dollars a year.
By the way, what does that mean, contingent?
Contingent incorporates both full-time, off the tenure track, about 20% of all faculty teach off the tenure track, and part-time.
And when you say a couple thousand, just give us an average of an adjunct professor, their salary and the courses they might be teaching.
If you annualize the salaries of the majority of contingent faculty members, they earn less than $20,000 a year.
So, Sandy Unger, you know, that seems to be the biggest complaint. Now, we should say right away that your total compensation, which is right there in the Chronicle of Higher Learning for everyone to see, $379,000 in salary and benefits, that's on the low end of the president's salaries.
Well, I'm not here to talk about my salary, Robin, but I'm not one of those people up in the millions.
No, you certainly aren't.
Obviously.
But what do you say about the complaint that across the board, president salaries are so much higher than professor salaries and adjunct professor salaries?
Well, first, a minor, not so minor perhaps, footnote, is that sometimes the salaries that get reported, these figures all come from the Form 990, which nonprofit institutions file with the federal government. And there are sometimes some distortions inherent in them, and, you know, all kinds of benefits and things are counted that most people don't count in their salaries. And also, if anybody in the list who's finishing up a job or who's been in the job for a certain period of time, there may be deferred compensation and things like that that get counted all in one year because of some IRS rules. And I actually think there's sometimes some double reporting, because the amount of deferred compensation is reported annually, and then it's reported as a lump sum as well at the end.
But still in all, I mean, you know,
the salaries are perhaps to some surprisingly high. And in some research institutions and some state universities, they are indeed very high. First, I want to say that, you know, we're looking at these two pieces that Mark Bousquet and I wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Education that is out today. And I disagree with very little of what Mark says in his piece. I think the conditions of adjunct faculty members, in particular part-time faculty members, is appalling. In our own institution here at Goucher College in Baltimore, we are trying to improve those salaries just as quickly and as fairly as we can. It is, I'm sure, crushing. crushingly disappointing to some people who have trained for so long and worked so hard to find it so difficult to make ends meet. And I am completely sympathetic with that. It is consistent with how we underpay teachers in general in this country.
Would you be agreeable to some of the suggestions that have been made that a president's salary shouldn't be more than five times an adjunct professor's? That would be, I think, Mark, you did the math, about $125,000. I mean, five times a worker's salary.
Robin, I think that makes good rhetoric, but I don't think it's going to happen. And so let's talk about what's realistic. I mean,
let me jump in for a moment, Sandy. I mean, I think, while it doesn't sound realistic if you are one of the people who are earning $500,000 a year and you have a platoon or really a fleet of people making less than $20,000 a year, it doesn't sound realistic. And yet in the military and in most state civil service pay grades, that's exactly what happens.
You acquire
competent executives, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, earn approximately five times what their lowest paid college-educated commissioned officer.
Right.
Sandy, go ahead.
First of all, those are government salaries, which are held to a certain level, reviewed every year by Congress, and there's a level of control there that I don't think anybody is ready to put on salaries in higher education. I understand what you're saying, when I say it's not realistic, I don't think you're going to get sitting presidents of colleges and universities say, okay, fine, I'll take a two-thirds pay cut next year. Because they, too, have worked very hard to get where they are. They have, one of the things I try to explain in my piece is a crushingly huge responsibility. Not to put too fine a point on it, I was on the phone with parents of our students at midnight last night and the night before, Saturday and Sunday nights of a weekend. This is something nobody sees when they look at the position of college and university president.
Well, so, Sandy Unger, you say that that's one of the problems, that even your own son didn't know what a college president did. He thought
very few people know.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, but what do they do that that deserves that salary? Go
ahead.
Well,
I don't know what deserves a salary and what doesn't. I know that executives in a lot of situations have a lot of responsibilities and get, you know, what's a bank president worth?
The funny thing, you mentioned that a lot of people are saying maybe not as much anymore. I mean, given what's happening on Wall Street, where we're seeing the huge disparity between CEO salaries and worker salaries, it seems as if the spotlight might be on college presidents a little more right now.
I don't think we should resist having the spotlight on us. I don't have a problem with that at all.
That's Sanford Unger, president of Goucher College outside Baltimore, Maryland. We want to hear more about what presidents do. We will with him. And Mark Bousquet is associate professor of cultural studies at Santa Clara University. Their commentaries about pay packages for college presidents appear in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And when we come back, Mark says presidents should be held accountable for how many kids complete college. So we'll hear more from both gentlemen. And later today, a real whip turn. We're going to speak with a conservative pastor in Texas who delivered his sermon from a bed yesterday because he wants his married congregants to, well, go to bed more often together. That's later. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation about the pay packages of college presidents with Sanford Unger, president of Goucher College in Baltimore, and Mark Bousquet, associate professor of cultural studies at Santa Clara University in California. Their commentaries about pay for college presidents appear in the Chronicle of Higher Education, along with a survey of pay packages of presidents of private and public colleges across the country. And Sandy, you were talking about the work that people don't see, how you were on the phone at midnight with parents of students. Tell us more about what college presidents do.
We are in charge of the academic program, the facilities, the lives of students, political associations, whether we're public or private institutions.
Going hat in hand to local officials.
And a great deal of fundraising. Again, I don't complain about that. I actually enjoy fundraising, which may sound sick, but I do.
I want to stay with that for a second. Mark, there's another article in the Chronicle pointing out that in Washington, for instance, the state of Washington, the competition for good college presidents has driven two school salaries there up. Mark Emmert at University of Washington makes $887,000. Elson Floyd at Washington State University makes about $623,000. So they're paying more because they're competing to get, you know, the better people to come to their schools. But in return, they feel deal that both men also compete to bring in more money. Emmert got $1 billion in research money for his school. Floyd at Washington State landed the largest private grant ever in that school, $25 million from Bill and Melinda Gates. And some people there say these men earned every penny that they're paid because of what they're bringing into the school. What about that thinking?
First of all, I think it's reasonable for administrators to earn high salaries in relationship to performance. The real question, though, is what are you asking them to do? So if you look at completion rates for higher education, college completion rates in the United States have remained flat since the 1970s.
Completion rates? Oh, you mean people finishing school?
That's right. They are particularly disappointing with low-income students, with African-American students, with Hispanic students. And the reason for that, an increasingly large body of research is showing, is the way that colleges are staffed. So there's a close relationship between the percentage of faculty who work on contingent appointments in these conditions where they don't have an office, they can't expect to be there. The reason they're calling the president at midnight is because they don't have a faculty member to call at midnight. And so the relationship between the staffing practices, which is one of the things we ask administrators to do, which is to control costs by these ultra-cheap contingent faculty arrangements, we ask them to do that. And if we ask them to change the staffing ratio, we would have an impact on completion rates.
And Sandy, you said you're sympathetic with the idea that there should be more pay for adjunct professors, more tenured, more salaried professors.
I think we should try to increase the percentage of our faculty who are on secure appointments. Too many people are on insecure appointments and are being paid at a level that is appalling.
Well, I'm wondering if you could maybe speak for other college presidents as well. but if you did as Mark suggested, if colleges college presidents did as Mark suggested in his article, and maybe worked on doubling the pay of the lowest paid campus worker, and raised money for that instead of raising money for building, let's say, a brand new a gym facility, which we hear, colleges are told they have to have to lure kids. If you did that, how would your board respond? I mean, in other words, can a college president, with the pressure on them to lure kids in, would they get the backing of the board and the school if they decided to, I'm going to focus attention on raising money for salaries as opposed to a new climbing wall?
Well, I can't speak for all boards at all, and I can make a stab at speaking for presidents. Of course, I mean, I am very focused on raising money to secure faculty salaries, and I don't think there'd be any objection to that whatsoever, to raise more money for faculty salaries, and I hope to be able to do it myself in the capital campaign we're working on now. I don't think it's an issue of facilities or faculty salaries. I think for the most part the facilities in higher education in this country are desperately in need of upgrading. Many of them have been neglected. There are deferred maintenance issues of a very serious nature. And so when places like Goucher College are building a brand new library in what we're calling an Athenaeum, I mean, this is not some luxury wasted facility. We need a new library.
If I can jump in, Cindy,
sure.
I do have to say that while certainly there are in some cases crumbling infrastructure, what you really have is a crumbling faculty. The average completion rate at a community college in 2006 was less than 25%.
But Mark, I want to jump in and ask you just a closing thought from each of you. Mark, what would you like to see? I mean, how would you like to see it legislated? I mean, how would you like to see a change made?
Individual faculties have to say, is the presidential pay closely related to the performance that matters? And if you have completion rates below 50% for four-year institutions, below 25% for a community college, the issue is rebuilding a faculty that has crumbled, not rebuilding an infrastructure.
But who would hold the school accountable? I mean, how would you reduce a public university in particular, a president's pay?
Taxpayers should absolutely hold administrators responsible for graduation rates at their institutions.
And Sandy, we're hearing from the Chronicle that some college presidents are declining bonuses or raises, at a time when kids can't get their student loans because they're tied up in the Wall Street mess. Do you think presidents should make some sacrifices?
I think presidents, of course, make sacrifices. I think one of the questions that's not often asked is how much do the presidents give back? And I think most of us give a great deal back to our institutions and to other people, and do a lot of volunteer service that is very significant. I think that completion rates are very important, but one of the things that's happened is we have not prepared people for college in secondary schools the way they need to be. And a community college president cannot perform a miracle. So this is not waving a magic wand and fixing it and slashing the president's salary until it's fixed.
Sanford Unger, president of Goucher College in Towson, Maryland, and Mark Bousquet, associate professor of cultural studies at Santa Clara University, both of them talking about college president salaries. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, outside of a college presidency, where are the jobs? What sector of the economy is growing? Well, hint, how do you look in a headlamp? That's tomorrow. It's mining, by the way. Still ahead today, why should we forgive mortgage holders their debts? One economist says, because the Bible tells us so. After the news, Here and Now. The much-debated question is, what should be done with the people who find themselves in trouble because of risky mortgages? Should the government bail them out? Should they be allowed to sink into foreclosure or bankruptcy? Well, two essays on the subject appear in the publication In Character, a journal of everyday virtues. It's published by the nonprofit John Templeton Foundation. The authors join us today. David Abramowitz is with the Center for American Progress. He says, look to the Bible and forgive people their debts. But Nicole Gelinas is with the Manhattan Institute, and she says, look to Edith Wharton, and you'll realize that debtors should feel some remorse for their bad decisions. So, David, let's start with you. As we said, you quote the Bible to say they're all better off morally and economically if we use avenues of forgiveness. So make your case.
I look to the Bible because the Bible has values around what happens in a market and property. So take the Jubilee, that every 50 years and every 7 years, debts are forgiven.
I think where's this in the Bible?
This is in Leviticus and several other places. Mm-hmm. I think that it's instructive today, not that the Bible is an economic handbook for modern America, but it gives a view that even if you start with a fair distribution of property and resources, which is the background of handing the property out to the tribes in a fair allocation, it recognizes that in human affairs, over time, property will concentrate with some people and other people will be without property. And over time, you're going to have such an imbalance that it is unhealthy for all of us. And I think that's a good lesson for today. We're at a point of wealth concentration that reminds us of right before the Great Depression, that reminds us of right before the Gilded Age.
So you're saying that the Bible, Leviticus, in this Jubilee, mandates that every 50 years or 7 years, that there be land redistribution. Are you saying that Leviticus is advocating communism?
I think a lot of people would be surprised if that their Bible were interpreted that way. No, I think Leviticus and the Bible are advocating some long-held, well-understood human truths that people who say the free market alone is the measure of human success have forgotten.
One last thought from you before we move to Nicole.
Yeah.
You point out that one of the lines that you're referring to is actually on our Liberty Bell. It's inscribed with the words, proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. And it goes on to say what?
It goes on to say in the Bible, it shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family.
Nicole, it's right there on the Liberty Bell. What are your, you know, tell us your thoughts. And you go back to Edith Wharton now. You're quick to say you don't want to completely go back to the time of Edith Wharton where people were, you know, absolutely scandalized if they had debt. But what are you saying about debt?
It's, to me, a matter of degree. And I looked to Edith Wharton to find an example of how forcing people to make good on their worst debts is certainly not what we want to do. If you go and look at The House of Mirth, this is a book about an unpaid debt. Lily Bart, who is an upper middle class young woman who finds herself falling into financial difficulties, borrows a sum of money from a wealthy older gentleman. She finds out that she is to offer certain favors in return for this money that she did not expect to have to offer. And Lily tortures herself to death in just the span of a couple of years trying to repay this debt. The last thing that she does before she dies of a drug overdose is to put the check to this gentleman on the bureau and say, I've finally repaid this debt. And we certainly don't want somebody 10 years from now not able to send their child to college because that person thought home equity would go up and up forever and borrowed to buy a big screen TV. It's certainly acceptable to have people's debts forgiven through the normal bankruptcy process. I would differ with David, though, in that I don't think that people who got in way over their heads in terms of mortgage debt should be able to go to a bankruptcy judge and have that debt written down so that they can stay in the house, because it sets a terrible precedent for the next time.
Nicole, I visited Edith Wharton's house in Western Mass, The Mount, and it's in bankruptcy. And in bankruptcy, they have more rights in bankruptcy than a homeowner does. Donald Trump has more rights in a bankruptcy than a homeowner does. If you're going to have a situation where the consequences of being wrong about your bet on your loan is foreclosure, then you ought to have it completely fair going in, and you ought to have a level playing field between a commercial landlord and an individual.
Nicole, what about that? And this is something the Democrats, Barney Frank, people are pushing for. You can get a bankruptcy judge if you're defaulting on your boat. You can get a bankruptcy judge if you're defaulting on your summer home. What about having a bankruptcy process available for a judge process available for people going into foreclosure, so that they can at least negotiate this?
When you borrow for an asset like a boat, if you run into trouble, that debt can be renegotiated down through the bankruptcy process. However, the lending institution charges you a higher interest rate relative to a first home residential mortgage because they are pricing in that risk. If we are going to say that residential home debt is also going to be subject to this judicial discretion in bankruptcy, that means that in the future, mortgage debt will also carry a higher interest rate. So we will, in effect, be making future responsible borrowers pay for the past indiscretions of lenders and borrowers alike housing boom.
I think, though, that what we're seeing is we are all in this economy together. So the notion that, to some degree, the risk of the economy getting out of control is socialized, whether it's by a little bit higher interest rate that everybody pays, or whether it's through the far more massive bailout and tax consequences that we're going to have, I think in an era of deregulation, that what we have to get back is to a common view that these regulations, in fact, are not impeding a sound economy. They are promoting a sound economy. A well-regulated economy is actually a healthy economy.
Absolutely. We need much better regulations. However, when it comes back to mortgage debt going through bankruptcy, this would not be a small difference in interest rates. This would be, you know, the difference between 6% mortgage and 8% mortgage, perhaps even higher for the worst credit risk, because these would be seen as at risk for a bankruptcy by the lender, and they would be charged a much higher rate. So you can see the trade-off. Yes, allowing mortgage debt to go through the bankruptcy process might protect certain borrowers, but for the large majority, they would be charged much higher rates and in not an insubstantial number of cases shut out of borrowing to purchase a home altogether.
Nicole Gelinas is with the Manhattan Institute, David Abramowitz with the Center for American Progress, with two differing views on whether debtors should entirely be forgiven. Their essays are published in the Journal of the John Templeton Foundation. He was one of the world's richest men. The man behind the Templeton Funds gave away millions of dollars to fund research into the intersection of science and spirituality. As we've just heard, we'll link you to Nicole and David's essays at our website, here-now.org. I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you, David.
Okay, don't forget, before we go today, if you thought Lilith on Cheers was a stiff, well, then you never saw her dance. And we will. We're going to attend a master class with B.B. Newirth a little later in the program. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we want to note something that happened in church yesterday, and oddly, this may not be a conversation for kids, because Dallas area pastor Ed Young delivered his sermon from a bed yesterday, and in it, he issued a challenge to his 20,000-member congregation to have sex. In fact, to have sex every day for a week, if, of course, they're married. Ed Young of the Fellowship Church in Grapevine, Texas, joins us. And, Pastor, what is this all about?
It's really about God, because God is the one who made love. He invented it, and he wants those of us who are married to make love. So we just threw it out there and said, okay, have sex over the next 7 days. And what we want them to do is to actually journal what they're feeling, what they're going through. Because, you know, to get to the bedroom, you got to get through a lot of different issues, like maybe some hurt feelings, some forgiveness, some anger, et cetera. So we're having both the husbands and the wives to journal their thoughts in a book that I came up with. And then we're going to have them email their thoughts and findings during the week of whoopee and after the a week of sex.
Well,
and then we're also going to do kind of a service and a talk to see what has happened because of it. If you show me a couple that has a fantastic sex life, I'll show you a couple that has a great marriage. And far too long, the church has allowed our culture to hijack sex, and the church has said, don't do it. And the world is saying, do it with whomever, whenever, however. Well, it's time, I think, that we bring the bed back in church and put God back in the bed.
Well, it's getting sort of crowded there in that bed because you have, like, the whole congregation on emails and everything. But you're not the first to do this. The Florida church had a 30-day sex challenge earlier this year. And we know, of course, there was the couple who tried to have sex every day for a year. It was called 365 Nights, A Memoir of Intimacy. It's a struggle people see at a certain point. And I'm just wondering, you know, are you maybe forcing congregants in a direction that they may actually need a therapist for? I mean, do you worry that you're going to get back in return some questions and issues and couple quandaries that maybe are a little bit of, beyond your expertise?
Well, you know what? We have challenged for years couples to seek marriage counseling, as I've done during this whole series, as I did this past weekend. I said, listen, you know, some of these issues that you're going to deal with are definitely too complex and you know, too difficult just to deal with in a 2 or 3 hour discussion. So, yeah, we encourage that. And then when they understand the fact in the marriage vows and throughout Scripture that the Bible says if you're married, your body is not your body. Not only is your body God's, but your body is your spouse's. It's a very unselfish relationship. I don't think couples are having enough sex. And I think they want to, but I think kids, and I define kids as keeping intimacy at a distance successfully. I think kids get in the way. I think that our careers can get in the way. I think commitments, being overcommitted and overstimulated and over the top, all that stuff can get in the way. Fatigue can get in the way. So we're just simply doing what the Scriptures say.
Well, we should make clear that you view a couple, a married couple, as a man and a woman, so you're not extending it to same-sex couples. And also, I'm wondering, what about the single people in your church?
For the single people, we told them to do two things this week. Number one, we told them to eat chocolate cake every day. And I think some of the wives said, man, that sounds better than sex. But, but seriously, what we did challenge them to do was we challenged them to pray for the thousands and thousands of married couples. And also, we challenged them to pray for their future marriages.
Ed Young, pastor of the Fellowship Church in Grapevine, Texas, who's encouraging his heterosexually married church members to have sex every day this week. So don't be calling anyone down in Grapevine this week. They're kind of busy. Pastor, we should very briefly note, you and your wife of 26 years, the mother of your four children, are going to try to participate as well.
Yes, we are right now in the middle of...
Oh, don't say that. Oh, I thought you meant at this moment.
No, I didn't mean right now, but I mean, yeah, we're in the challenge. Yeah.
Pastor Young, best to you.
I don't know what I said, anyway.
Best to you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, for a minute there, I thought, too much information. A quick program note, later this week, singer-songwriter John Hyatt will be here with new music. Back in a minute with dancer Bebe Neuwirth, Here and Now. Welcome back. Dancer and actress Bebe Neuwirth is best known for playing Lilith Sternin, the repressed psychologist married to Dr. Fraser Crane on the TV show Cheers. But at heart, she's a Broadway dancer who's won Tony Awards in 1986 for Sweet Charity, in 1994 for Damn Yankees, two musicals made famous by the dance numbers of Bob Fosse. Neuwirth became a disciple of Fosse, whose signature burlesque-inspired sophistication was seen in one of the best movies he directed, Cabaret. Well, after a career of dancing on stage, Neuwirth now has two titanium hips, but about to enter her 50s, this isn't slowing her down. We sat down with Bebe Neuwirth after she taught master classes to dance students at Harvard. They were trying to get the sexy Fosse style of a dance number from Pippin just right.
First, want to fix the music a little? Can I fix the music?
You can do everything that you want.
Can you make the music more like a ring, ding, 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 a little bit more, carnival, kind of like a little bit of a carnival? There is a different, no, you played it beautifully. There's a different dynamic that needs to happen, and it's going to help the dancers, and it will also help the irony of the piece. And that is
one of the things that I think is the most important thing to tell students, and I tried to convey this, was that they need to be true to their own selves as artists and as creative people and not try to copy anyone else. Now, when I was talking about and actually coaching them on the dance, the style of Fosse is very, very particular and very frequently misinterpreted, and I wanted to convey as well as I could what the authentic style is, as I understand it.
Can you tell us now what you think that is?
It has to do with being very elegant, and yet at the same time there's a sort of a secrecy, and there's sort of it's not bump and grind in your face. It's very, very sexy, but it comes from a sensual place.
And this leg is straight. Your left leg is straight, and it's very easy. Everybody pull up. There's a lot of, as a general note overall, everything is too down here. It's, I know it seems like a little thing, but that's the thing, God's in the details with Fosse, and great. Okay, so
it is misinterpreted because a lot of people look at it and go, "Wow, that's so sexy." Here, let me try, and they make big bumps and grinds. Bob Fosse almost never did a front bump. Your hips never did that front bump, which is, literally sexual. They went to the side, they went to the back, they went diagonally to the back. They made circles. So there is an economy of movement, and there is something kind of wry about the dancing.
Okay, this step, thanks. There you go. It's just a little trucking. And it's really elegant. It's like this little, hey, it's a little vaudeville, little vaudevillian guy. And your arms are here like... Yeah, you're all doing this with your canes. I did that too. I think you might be better off without your forefinger down it. Right, kind of. But give them some muscularity. I mean, don't just have them like this. They're alive and they're happening with you.
We're talking about the classes that you held with the Harvard students, talking to them about Bob Fosse. We know you made your mark in many of his shows, but I'm not sure. Did you work directly with him?
Yes, I did. I have that blessing in my life.
So what was that like, working with him? I mean, how would you sum that up? Oh,
you know, people throw this word genius around a lot. And they say, oh, that person's a genius or that's genius. And then you work with someone who is a genius, and it's mind-blowing. It is, that's a whole other world. It fills your heart. It fills your soul. It's not just your mind that gets blown. It just fills you up, and it's just extraordinary. He was a genius.
Can you tell the uninitiated? I mean, what was it that the way he moved, the way he helped you move in a certain way? What was it?
It was everything. It was just everything. There is a purity of intention and clarity of the original creative gesture. And so everything that he did, everything he choreographed, everything he directed, everything he said, everything he did and how he moved served that particular specific vision. And so if you paid attention, you couldn't help but to do good work for him. Go and look at his movies, and you will never see the people who are in those movies, you'll never see them, I don't think, do better work than they did in those movies. Cabaret, Liza Minnelli, Michael York, they've never been better than that. And I always try to keep him in the back of my head, you know, no matter what job I'm doing, and thinking, how would he help me with this? What would he say?
Well,
what would Bob Fosse do?
Well, what would Bob Fosse do? What? How would Bob Fosse inform Lilith in her relationship with Frasier?
You know, I was working on that. Actually, the first time I did an episode was while I was working with him. So, you know, he informed it in as much as I was learning how to work a certain way. And so when I approached Lilith, I suppose, in the scenes, I was trying to be as specific and clear and honest as I could, which was really all he asked.
She certainly had a bearing.
Well, I think as a dancer, when I work as an actress, I tend to work from the outside in, because if I understand how a person sits and walks and stands and moves and even talks, then that tells me a little bit about them. So I work as a dancer, and I work as a singer, and as I work as an actress.
You teach?
Now I'm starting to do a little bit of teaching, which is really thrilling. That's very, very interesting to me, to help to pass down the language and the style of Bob Fosse in as authentic a way as I possibly can. As I say, it is so misinterpreted so frequently.
Is this making sense at all to you? Yeah? Okay. Can you do that again? From the... And remember, it's both arms up, bow, one arm up, three, four, five. This is a really nice step here. That's cool. So really enjoy that. Okay. It's fun for me. I don't know.
And I even feel bad, you know, teaching some things that I wasn't there when he actually taught it, although I learned it from someone who learned it from him. I even feel like that might not be quite pure enough, you know. But I liked it when I got to actually have the students come up on stage and I could work physically with them. I could show them what I meant. It's very, very important to me. And I know some other Fosse dancers, and a lot of us feel the same way. We really want to make sure that this gets taught as purely and authentically as possible.
Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about
it. Okay.
Thanks for asking.
So really, really, everything is very subtle, very small. You don't have to do it. It's just...